Celebrating 20 years, the New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project, brings the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora to the DMV at the AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. From March 15 to the 28th, the festival features 26 films from 16 countries, including 3 years premieres and discussions with filmmakers. Explore the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa at the 2024 New African Film Festival. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver. Or call 301-495-6700. 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good evening. It's just about 6 p.m. in the nation's capital. The name of the show is News Views. My name is Garland Nixon on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. You can find me online, Garland Nixon. I have a YouTube show. You can find me on Facebook, of course, Garland Nixon. Not a whole lot of them. I'm on Telegram and I'm on Instagram. All right. You know, the big news now is Haiti. And I have a friend who I have on tonight to talk about Haiti. Before I get started with my friend, I just want to, you know, reiterate, and that is something, and that is, you know, week after week, you know, I have some common themes. And if you know me, you know, one of the common themes is I understand the U.S. empire. I understand the history of the U.S. empire. I understand the present of the U.S. empire. And when I have people who call in and they, you know, are basically arguing the U.S. government's doing the right thing here and there, or they're trying to help, they're trying to do good, I point to the reality that show me an instance in history where that was the case, because I can't find one. I can't find one. They lie to us over and over. They go around the world stealing people's stuff, overthrowing governments, assassinating leaders, especially in Africa, Latin America, et cetera. And then they come home and they tell the same old lies to the American people. Yeah, we're helping that country to look out for the good of the people. And they just happen to have oil and gold and things of that nature. But that has nothing to do with it. I just don't understand why the suckers always believe that stuff. But I have with me now my dear friend Kim Ives. Kim, welcome to WPFW. Oh, he's not on yet? Kim's not on yet. Okay, let me text Kim. Whoa, I thought I had Kim on, but I will text him. Kim, who should be on, I'm just going to let him know we're standing by. See what he says. Okay, Kim is the editor at Haiti Liberté. So hopefully he shall be on any second. And it's Haiti, H-A-I-T-I, Liberté, L-I-B-E-R-T-E. Haiti Liberté with an E at the end, .com. It's a great website. There is an English version there, and you know, you can learn a lot. But Kim Ives, welcome back to WPFW.
Oh, thank you very much, Carlin. Glad to be with you.
Always a pleasure. Yeah, you know what I was saying before, and I say this, you know, this is a common theme that I say to my listeners. You know, I put it like this. There's two kinds of people. There's people who understand U.S. foreign policy, and there's people who support it, because you can't do both unless you're a very evil person. If you understand the history and the context of U.S. foreign policy, how they've treated the countries in Africa and Latin America, when they come with the next lie, yes, we're going there to help this country to stand up for democracy, to look out for the common man, you either throw up or laugh. If you understand their foreign policy. So let's move on with Haiti. In regards to Haiti, speaking of U.S. foreign policy and imperialism against Haiti, here's something I want to, let's start by giving people a brief history of the U.S. and how they've treated Haiti. Not too much in depth, because we got a lot to get into, but a brief history. If someone said, if from the U.S. said, we're here to look out for Haiti, we're going to help them out, we're going to do the right thing, from a historical context, why should we be suspect of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Garland. Eric Adams here in New York had a rally, or he didn't have it, but some of the council people had it. Basically, politicians on the steps of City Hall in New York. And I was invited to speak, and that's how I began. Across the plaza there, there's a, you know, statue of Nathan Hale and, you know, the American Revolution, da-da-da. And I said, well, you know, that's the big myth that we have, or are taught in this country, is that this was the first free democracy of the Western Hemisphere, which is completely untrue. It was a nation founded by slave owners, slaveholders, and there was only democracy for white slaveholding or property-owning men. And Haiti was the opposite. That was the first true free democracy in the hemisphere. Haiti was the one who forged that in 1804, about 30 years after the Americans. And it was really the touchstone for all the revolutions on the continent. And the U.S., in fact, during the Haitian Revolution, the U.S. sold guns to the Haitian revolutionaries, which is interesting because that's used as kind of a trope to say, oh, you know, those people in Haiti, they have today, they have U.S. guns, so it must mean they're U.S. puppets, but no. Anyway, after the revolution triumphed, of course, the slave-owning class of the U.S. totally panicked, and Haiti and Gerald Horn details this in one of his books, how they did everything they could to sort of repress the word of the Haitian revolution in the various ports of the United States in that period up until the Civil War. So he was embargoed for the first 60 years of U.S. history and of its history. And it wasn't until after the Emancipation Proclamation. And then the U.S. did a good bit of gunboat diplomacy, as did the Europeans, during the periods between 1860 and 1915. But in 1915, they landed U.S. Marines. They occupied the country for 19 years and basically reestablished slavery by doing what was called the Corvée Law, where they put peasants who were resisting them to work on road projects and to build buildings. And then there was a succession of U.S.-backed dictators. François Papa Doc Duvalier and his son, Baby Doc Duvalier, ruled Haiti from 1957 to 1986 with U.S. backing, because Haiti was, at that point, a sort of bulwark against Cuba. And then after 1986 and Jean-Claude Duvalier's overthrow, Haiti has been pretty much tumultuous, and it's been the scene of two coup d'etat, well, three coup d'etats, one in 1991, one in 2004, one in 2021, and two interventions, and they're trying to organize a third intervention now as we speak.
If you could, we recently, I don't know if the word is celebrated, remembered the coup of 2004 of President Aristide, which was a devious operation by the United States.
Against Aristide.
Against Aristide. If you could, and he was a guy, he was a person who the Haitian people actually elected and they wanted as a leader. If you could give us a, you know, understanding of what happened so that our, you know, this country that always, oh, we're here for democracy and we're opposed to dictators and blah, 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 we've got to support the people. Talk to us about what happened in 2004, in February, I believe it was, of 2004, when the U.S. government overthrew and kidnapped the leader of Haiti, the duly elected, democratically elected leader of Haiti.
Right, the first one, in fact.
Yeah.
It was the first free, fair election. Previously, presidents had been elected through the parliament. But basically for 50 years, 60 years from the 1920s to the 1980s, the U.S. and Europe to some extent, but the U.S. particularly, ran its neocolonies with strong men. Think, you know, Batista, Somoza, Stroessner, Pinochet, Duvalier. But they started to see this was counterproductive. It created too many Che Guevaras. And also these guys were very corrupt. A lot of the money they would send down to support businesses like building roads or electricity grids or whatever would get pocketed. And so they said, eh, this isn't working out really. So they started a new policy of demonstration elections, as Edward Herman called it, where they would try to do elections like they do here. The candidate with the most money wins, and they would, you know, put in some puppet. And they put the armies back in their barracks, and they said, okay, if there's trouble, we're going to send in the international peacekeepers, the UN. So the UN became kind of this peacekeeping force. So in 86, the U.S. more or less consents, gives the nod, allows Duvalier to fall. And they thought they were just going to plug in a World Bank technocrat called Marc Bazin. They thought it would be easy, one, two, three, bada-bing, bada-bang. But no, didn't work out like that at all. The Haitian people rose up. And there was a liberation theologian, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was anti-imperialist and, you know, talking a pretty hard game against U.S. domination. And he was elected over Marc Bazin, the neoliberal candidate. It was about 70% of the vote when they finished, when they stopped counting. I think they didn't want it to be more. And so he swept the election, nothing they could do. And they were kind of, you know, dumbfounded, shocked that the Haitian people did this. Well, they corrected that within 8 months. They did the coup. And Aristide spent 3 years in exile, first in Venezuela and
if you could,
in Washington.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Go on. And what year was that?
That was 91.
Okay.
91, in September 91. So September 91, he's couped. Aristide sent out. And they figure, okay, that's at first, I remember very well, James Baker, who was the Secretary of State at the time, went to the OAS, you know, where they had an emergency meeting and the Haitians are demonstrating outside. He says, the coup will not stand, you know. And so everybody said, wow, that's weird. Bush number one, of course, is against the coup. But over the weekend, they changed it. And they said, well, really, Aristide deserved it because he was organizing mobs and gangs. And there was mob violence, right?
Oh, so, we heard that. They played that. So this isn't the first time they played that hand.
No, they haven't played. Yeah, they practiced this one a little bit. So then they started 3 years of tractations, as they say in French. I'm not sure if it's an English word, but, you know, a back and forth and negotiations and delegations, OAS, CARICOM, blah, 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 going back and forth. And finally, weirdly and uniquely, Clinton brought Aristide back in 1994, but in a cage, basically on the shoulders of 23,000 U.S. troops, which horrified a lot of Haitians, especially on the left. And that was the first occupation since the 1915 to 1934 occupation. And that lasted 6 years. So Aristide did a policy, not to go too much into the weeds here, but what in Haiti is a kind of a specialty there called marronage, which is, you know, when they tell you to do something, you say, yes, boss, but you don't do it exactly. You mm-hmm. kind of take a sidestep or a step back. So that's called marronage, just kind of passive resistance. So Aristide did that. They brought him back to basically, they said, we're bringing you back, but you're going to put in our neoliberal plan. You're going to privatize all the state industries. You're going to, you know, slash the payrolls. And, you know, Aristide got in and made like, well, I kind of, it's a problem. I got this problem, that problem. And pretty soon they were totally fed up with him. And they.
When you say they were fed up with him, what you mean is the U.S. The U.S. was.
Yeah, Washington. Yeah, what? Washington was totally fed up with him. And they said, listen, you're not recouping the 3 years you spent in exile, which is what the Haitian people were demanding. Well, you're getting the heave-ho. And they brought in another guy who was called his twin. It was a guy called René Préval, who was more amenable to bowing to the Washington and wasn't doing the marronage as much. And he was the one who ended up carrying out a lot of the privatizations and neoliberal reforms on the Haitian economy. But this made him very unpopular with a lot of Haitians. And of course, in 2000, because you can't go back to back in Haiti, you got to take 5 years off. Mm-hmm. You can run twice, but you got to take 5 years off. So Aristide took his 5 years off, basically from 96 to 2000, and came back in 2001. But now the Americans said, okay, well, this time we got to make it really stick. And unfortunately, he came in at the same time as George Bush number two, Jr. And he, of course, had a bunch of neocons with him. I think Otto Reich, Roger Noriega, and a lot of others. And they said, you know, we're getting this guy out of there no matter what. But he was like target number one. He was the low-hanging fruit. So they started a 3-year campaign, which involved diplomatic, economic sanctions, diplomatic pressure, economic sanctions, a kind of contra-force in the form of guerrillas, which were coming across the border from the Dominican Republic. And by 2004, on February 29th, the U.S. came to his house, basically read him the riot act, said, "You're getting on a plane." You know, he tried, Malinaj, he tried to get out of it, but they got him on the plane. They flew him to Africa, and he spent the next 7 years in exile in Africa.
So let me just really clarify this. The Haitian people, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, they had elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide as the president of Haiti. The Haitian people, yep, overwhelmingly, he wins.
Twice.
Okay. The second time, Americans come in with an American plane. They kidnap Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the president, yes, of Haiti, and they fly, yes, him to Central Africa. And they install and say, okay, elected president, you ain't no longer the president, you're out of here. And they basically said, this guy over here, he's the president now. Do I have it right?
Exactly. You got it right.
Yep.
And then to enforce that, they brought in first French, Canadian, and U.S. troops for the first 3 months after that February 29th. On March 1st, they all arrived. And then they stayed there for 3 months. But, you know, it cost too much, so they got the troops that you pay half price, like from Sri Lanka, mm-hmm, or Nepal or wherever.
Mercenaries.
And, basically brought those guys in, and they were there for 13 years. It was supposed to be 6 months, Garland, but they ended up staying till 2017, they did a lot of damage, a lot of massacres, a lot of rapes, and it brought, wow, cholera to the country, and that's a lot of what caused the situation today, as Jemima Pierre often argues that, you know, really the problems began with the 2004 coup. I would actually say they began almost in the 1994 time when Aristide agreed to let them come in, but that's another story.
And, you know, what we're seeing today is, I had some friends asking me the other day about Haiti. What's going on with Haiti? Oh, I hear the gangs have gone crazy, and the gangs are not, you know, no discussion of the U.S. overthrowing the government of Haiti repeatedly, stealing their stuff, installing puppet leaders, just completely destroying the country year after year. There's evil, bad gangs everywhere. And the implication is, well, the United States has to come in and set things right, right? The criminal, right, the person who robbed your house, now they're going to come. The person who set your house on fire and burned it to the ground says, hey, you know what? I think we'll come in and build you a new house. No, thanks. I mean, do I kind of have that right?
You got it right. It's just like, you know, the whole problem in Israel-Palestine started on October 7th, right?
Oh, right. That's right. Nothing was going on in October 7th. October 6th was not, it was fine.
Yeah, everything was fine. So, yeah, this is, of course, the thing. I don't know who they think they're fooling, because they're not fooling people anymore. And the Haitians certainly aren't fooled. And this rally that I began to our talk with on City Hall step, you know, they started with a couple of politicians saying, oh, we have to stop the gangs and bring in troops and da-da-da. But by the end, it turned into an anti-occupation rally denouncing U.S. imperialism. So, you know, the things are getting out of their hands.
You know, I find, and I say this to my listeners, and I'll just get you a comment on it. When you look at the history of the U.S. government, right, from, you know, yeah, slavery to apartheid to, you know, massacring the Native Americans, right? When you look at the U.S., the history of the U.S. in Central America, overthrowing government after government and installing dictators, you go to Africa, you know, and country after country, overthrowing the governments, installing dictators, massacring people all over the place. The thing that shocks me the most, to be quite frank, is the American people. How you can watch somebody lie, steal, murder, overthrow governments, assassinate people, coup governments, and then all they got to do is put a story in the Washington Post to say, yeah, the Haitian people, gangs are going, blah, 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 blah. And people will believe it again. At what point, to me, does it dawn on you that you're being had? I mean, maybe that's a little too broad. Do you have a thought on that?
Well, yeah. You know, when I first got involved in political work, I was part of a thing called the Liberation Support Movement. And the premise of this movement was that, well, you know, this was in the 70s, huh? Was that really the working class in this country is not really ready for revolution because, you know, you had hard hats guys going beating up, you know, anti-war demonstrators in the Vietnam War. And they said, really, the leading edge of world revolution are the national liberation struggles in Africa at that time, Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, we're finding their independence, Central America, you had Nicaragua, El Salvador, et cetera, rising up. So a lot of it became support. And the reason they said was because, in fact, the U.S. working class gets, and Marx and Engels actually wrote about this in their day with respect to the Irish and British working classes. The American working class was getting super profits, really, off the backs of the poor, the wretched of the earth, as Fanon called them, the denier de la terre, in the third world, where you know, people were working for a buck a day instead of at that time $5 or $6 an hour here in the United States. So, you know, they began to have sort of a privilege which allowed them to live in a bubble, you know, where they went to work at the plant and did their time and then come home and have a Budweiser and watch the television and go to bed and do it all over again and take a vacation every now and then. But that's coming apart now because the liberation struggles have been successful over this past 40, 50 years. And China is free, Cuba is free, Venezuela is pretty free, Nicaragua is pretty free, Bolivia, and all the super profits that were flowing out of these countries, and even in Haiti, you know, they've had basically uprising after uprising since 86. So now the working class here is starting very gradually to wake up, a little groggy, but still, you know, there's still a little bit of the leftovers of that period when they were sound asleep. And, you know, the working class here is beginning to wake up to a lot of these things, but, you know, there's still a lot of holdover of those decades of super profit sleep.
You know, one of the ways I like to, if we're discussing the, you know, issues of revolution, one of the ways I like to, the thing I like to talk about is, for instance, a Bernie Sanders, the so-called Bernie Sanders left, right? The people who say, hey, you know, the system's fine and, you know, we can, I'll put it to you like this. This is the kind of left that I see. What they seem to be saying is, look, there's a big pie of money in America, right? There's a big pie. Wall Street's going to get theirs. The military industrial is going to, certain corporations are going to get theirs. We got to make sure that the working class gets their fair slice of the pie, right? There's a pie, and I'm the left in America, and what I want to make sure is that the working class gets a fair slice of the pie, which in and of itself sounds okay. Here comes the problem. But we don't want to discuss all the black and brown bodies that are baked into the pie from Latin America, from the Middle East, and from Africa. See, what they want to talk about is there is a pie and everybody gets the slice of the pie. Imperialism, U.S. foreign policy is saying, what about all them Africans? What about all of those Latin Americans? What about all of these Middle Easterners? What about all these Asians, people around the country, I mean around the world, who were abused, who were murdered, who were worked in sweatshops, whose governments were overthrown, who was denied democracy so that the United States could get the ingredients for the pie real cheap, and the only thing you want to talk about is getting your slice of a criminal pie that has dead people in it. Your thoughts?
Exactly, and that's exactly the policy of the AFL-CIO, which is sometimes called the AFL-CIA in Latin America, because, it's essentially the vision of, you know, we're going to get our part of the pie, as you say, but, you know, the rest of the world, okay. And, you know, we're 4% of the world's population, and we consume 45% of its resources. There's a reason everybody's trying to come here, why they're massing at the borders, because we've sucked up, vacuumed up all the wealth from their countries, all the surplus value in the form of cheap labor from their countries, and often destroyed their agriculture by dumping our, you know, combine produced rice or corn or whatever. So it is really, as Malcolm said, the chicken's coming home to roost. And, you know, some people are waking up. Some people are reacting, you know, by having the cold water suddenly thrown on them when they were asleep and saying, what, you know, don't let those people in here. You know, this is our place and we're going to keep them out, you know, but you can't keep them out as long as you keep destroying their livelihoods and their countries.
Yeah, they're following their money home. That's what they are. You took their money, you took their stuff, and you brought it here, and they're following the resources that you stole from them back here, saying, look, you took my stuff, and now you're living pretty good in America. Can I go there where you took all my stuff so you could live good? And in a way, the working class here have been bribed. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like the ruling elite said, look, you live in America. You're going to live a little bit better than the people in Africa, Latin America, or whatever. Right. So kind of keep your mouth shut and keep your eyes shut and keep your ears shut and pretend that you don't know what we're doing in Latin America and in Africa. Pretend like you're living good because you're smarter, because you work harder, because you're better. Don't even accept the fact that we stole those bananas. We stole that coffee. We murdered people to get those the chocolate beans and Nestle's and the United Fruit Company. We're going to ignore
don't
that they're over.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, don't forget about the coffee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. No, that's exactly it. I mean, the flight of capital brings about the flight of people because they are driven off their land, out of their countries, and they're looking for a place. And this is, where we have to bring the working class in this country. Yes, there are a lot of people who don't understand it, and they just have a instinctive, ignorant response. But a lot of people are waking up, and I think we, as ideological workers, as it were, have to have them understand that. These policies that they think are helping them are, in fact, destroying the little the tiny lifeboat of wealth that is floating in an ocean, a world of poverty.
And, you know, I'll say this, and I know we are talking about Haiti, but I think the issue, revolutionary conversation, is important. Donald Trump and Joe Biden and these their ilk understand this. So they'll say, yes, we're going to bring back, right? We're going to bring back these industrial jobs. We're going to bring back good jobs with good wages. They're saying we're going to reindustrialize. What they're saying is, hey, remember when it was pretty good in the 60s and 70s? Maybe even some of the 80s. Yeah, we need to go back to that time. And we're just the people that are going to take you back to that time. Now, they're not. They're lying. But here's the thing about it. And this is my point. Joe Biden, we're going to take you back to when things were good. Well, he can't. That's a fact. But let's just say for the sake of argument, that Joe Biden or Donald Trump could take us back to the 60s or 70s when there was more industry and jobs, right? Wouldn't this system get us right back where we are today? If you went back there and did the same things that they did, which were overthrowing countries in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, stealing their stuff, going to war around the world, genociding people. If you went back to the 60s and 70s when Americans were sitting here driving around in fast cars, not knowing that their government was overthrowing people, murdering and stealing their stuff. If you went back to that, it would inevitably bring you right back to where we are in this broken society again, Kim.
Exactly. And just to switch back to Haiti today, what they've done is they've so debilitated those societies that the state has collapsed and people are left to fend for themselves. That's what the quote unquote gangs are that they're talking about in Haiti today. These are simply people, neighborhood leaders, finding a way to survive. Now, some of them resort to criminality and preying off their brothers and sisters, which is no good, but some of them are trying to carry out revolutions in their society to create a society which is cooperative. And in the words of the number one gang leader in Haiti, Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, He said, basically, we want to go back to what our founding father, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said, all the wealth for all the people in our country.
Well, no wonder they hate Jimmy Barbecue Chérizy, a man who says all the wealth for all. You know what I found? And I say this, and sometimes it just freaks some of my listeners who are, you know, still inured to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or whatever. Whenever I see the United States government pointing to someone saying he's evil, I remember they hated our government hated Malcolm X and they killed him. Didn't like JFK, killed him. Martin Luther King couldn't stand him, killed him. Right? Muammar Gaddafi hated him, killed him. My history tells me that if they point to Jimmy Barbecue Chérizy or anybody and they say he's a bad guy, he most likely ain't that bad of a guy. That the bad guy is sitting here in Washington saying, how can we overthrow that government and steal all their stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think there should be a reflex on the enlightened left in our country. If you find yourself standing on the same position as the U.S. State Department, you better reexamine where you're standing.
Yeah. Well, you know, so, let me give you an example. Right now, if you're a Democrat, you know that Vladimir Putin and Russia, they're the most evil government that ever lived. Right now, if you're a Republican, then you know it's China. China? Oh, are you kidding me? They're the Chinese Communist Party. So you almost have like a couple of cults saying Russia's a threat and China's a threat. But here's what I ask you. Are Russia and China on our border? Or are we on theirs? We're on the border of Russia. The United States has troops. They've started, got a war going, overthrew the government of Ukraine. And here they are with this raging a war on Russia's border. Meanwhile, I just read an article today. The U.S. put troops on the Kinmen Islands just off the coast of China. The Kinmen Islands are 1 mile from China's border. We got troops 1 mile from China's border on the coastline. What would we do if Chinese troops were on Long Island, which is a mile from the border? You know what I'm saying? So the United States is on the border of Russia, on the border of China, and they can convince the American people that it's China and Russia are the bad guys.
Right. And, you know, this is, again, one of the reasons why the U.S. is fighting so hard now to keep Haiti. You would say, you know, why are you trying to keep Haiti? Well, you know, this is a population which is one of the last to the governments, the puppet governments have been recognizing Taiwan as China up until now, and they realize we're going to war with China, and they say we need a place to, you know, make our cheap things, all the things we use from electronics to garments, in a place where people are paid $5 a day to produce them, 12-hour days. So this is, you know, part of this whole push to kind of capture this Caribbean, which has been for years our, you know, cheap labor pool. But particularly Haiti is, you know, the cheapest labor in that region.
Wow. Now, right now, here's what we're hearing. The gangs are gone berserk, and the Americans, I guess, or something, or the UN at the hands of the Americans have to go in and set things straight. Kim, we've got to go in and we've got to straighten things out because the gangs are threatening the Haitian people. And God knows the United States is always looking out for the Haitian people. Kim, your thoughts on that?
Okay, so to show you how far behind the curve they are, they couldn't even use the old tool that they built back in the 1940s, the UN, to bring in this force, the UN peacekeeping force, because now the UN is compromised because you have Russia and China on the Security Council and they can veto this deployment. And so we here at Haiti Liberté, we addressed the Security Council on December 22nd, 2022, when they first proposed this question of sending a peacekeeping force into Haiti. It was at the request of the puppet of the U.S., Ariel Henry, who was never elected. He has absolutely no legitimacy whatsoever. But he came with this request, and we went there to say, no, UN, you cannot, you should not do this. And of course, we were mostly speaking to Russia and China, who we knew could give the veto. You know, each time they've done this in the past 30 years, they've messed the place up. They've, you know, raped, massacred, unleashed disease epidemics in the country. And now you want to do it again? You know, don't allow it. So what the U.S. did was they did an end run, as we say in football. They said, okay, we're going to make a force which is going to be a multinational security support force. That's what they call it, the MSS, multinational security support. And it will be independent. It is not going to be dispatched by the Security Council and have its oversight. It is instead going to be a force that we'll pay for it over here on the side. Right now, they're paying it out of the Pentagon budget. That's where they're sending money
and
left, trying to collect these guys. But all they got from the UN was a benediction, a sort of a blessing that the UN Security Council gave it, even though China and Russia abstained from it, said, we don't like it, it stinks. But so this is a new thing that they're doing. They're so on their back foot that they can't even get the UN peacekeeping force that they devised, you know, that formula that I talked earlier that they devised back in the mid-80s to intervene to, you know, crush the rebellion. They have to try to go, you know, recruit some Kenyans and Benin and Chad and et cetera, et cetera. And even there, they're having problems because the people in those countries are rebelling, saying, no, we're not. We don't want to go fight your wars. And they can't even get enough people from Kenya because the criteria for the soldiers, they wanted to get 1,000 cops from Kenya to send over, but the criteria was too high. What was the criteria? One, you have to be between the age of 20 and 60, and two, you have to have no more than 2 convictions. Well, they can only get 400 cops to meet that criteria. So this shows you what kind of situation we're in. I guess all the other cops have 3 to 4 convictions. But So, you know, the U.S. is just, I mean, it's almost comic if it weren't so tragic and if so many people weren't being killed by this murderous clique that's in power in this country and trying to buy other murderous cliques in their neo-colonies.
Now, the what we see on the news now is the president of Haiti, Ariel Henry. He was
prime minister.
He was flying around wherever, and he was supposed to come back to Haiti. And the gangs took over the airport, so he can't go, and he stepped down. And here's the bottom line: my understanding is, and so you can fill in everything you can, but I'll just give a basic sketch for the people that are listening. There was a president of Haiti who even was appointed by the U.S. He wasn't elected. His name was
He was elected.
Jovenel Moise. It was elected, but he continued on past when he was supposed to leave. Okay,
right.
Bottom line.
Right.
Jovenel Moise was president, and there was an assassination plot, and he was assassinated. He was machine gunned. And Ariel Henry, who is the current guy who just stepped down, was on the phone with the guy who set up the assassination immediately within hours after the assassination. And, might I add, the assassins, many of them were trained by the United States Drug Enforcement Administration. And there is a tremendous amount of evidence that the U.S. was pretty much, I'm pretty convinced, was the U.S. was behind the assassination of Jovenel Moise. And then, as I said, the guy that's so-called president now was on the phone with the assassin leader immediately after the assassination. Anyway, fill in all the holes for people to understand what happened and why it's reasonable to suspect that the U.S. was involved in the assassination of Jovenel Moise, the former Haitian president.
Okay,
late Haitian president. How about that? Go ahead.
Right. Okay, so I have to roll back a little bit to 2010. So Aristide's twin, they called him a twin, René Préval, had been in power since 2006. He was at the end of his term, and the earthquake hit. So when the earthquake hit in January 12, 2010, you know, it caused a lot of upside down. But basically, the U.S. occupied the country even more. They had left most of the operations in the hands of Minister, but they also brought in 20,000 troops just to make sure the Haitians didn't get any ideas and start looting and so forth. So that's them talking, not me.
Right, right.
So now they said, okay, but we got to have elections. We got to have elections no matter what. And so the election, Préval, and people can read about this in Haiti Liberté. You can go back to the WikiLeaks articles we did, because WikiLeaks gave Haiti Liberté 2,000 of the documents. When they tried to give the documents to the New York Times, the Guardian, Der Spiegel, Le Monde, they didn't do anything with them. And so they said, well, we got to go to the press of those countries, the good press, the press that will use them and put them out. And so we did that at Haiti Liberté with those. And it became one of the most successful series of articles on the basis of the WikiLeaks documents. So in that, we show how Préval was doing a kind of a marronage himself, where he made a deal with Venezuela to get cheap oil. And also Venezuela said, well, we're going to sweeten the pot a little. We're going to let you keep some of the money of the sales for 20 years. You can use it and pay us back. Okay, so they didn't like this at all about Préval. This is all laid out in that first article we did from the WikiLeaks documents. And, you know, so they were kind of looking to get him out. And the guy they chose was a guy called Michel Martelly, a sort of a compa singer. Compa is the national music. You know, he's the kind of guy who would, like, strip down to his underwear on stage and do very vulgar sort of grinding and whatever. Yeah. And so this is the guy they put in as president. And he was a neo-devaluerist, and he did it made a mess of the place. So when he was done in about 2015-16, he tagged Jovenel Moïse. Now, Jovenel Moïse was not like a figure in his party or anything. Jovenel Moïse was basically a very pragmatic peasant from the north, but he brought him in, one, because he thought he would be weak and be a good puppet, but two, you know, he was a straight-up peasant. You know, he looked like a peasant. He had kind of a, you know, big head and a spindly neck, and he wore these kind of large, ill-fitting suits. And so he said, this guy's perfect, you know. And so he threw in Jovenel Moïse, thinking, you know, when the 5 years is up and I can come back, you know, it'll be easy just for this guy to hand it back. Well, Moïse had a different idea, and he really wanted to improve the peasantry's life in the countryside. And so he was investing in roads and electrification projects and dams, canals, all kinds of things. And unfortunately, at that time, Trump had also come in. And Trump immediately slapped a bunch of sanctions on Venezuela, which was basically paying for all the things, or Jovenel had expected Venezuela to be able to pay for all these things, this Venezuela-Petrocaribe deal. But it couldn't continue because of the sanctions Trump put on Venezuela. So suddenly, Jovenel Moïse found himself having made a million promises, but no money to pay for it. So he turned to the bourgeoisie of Haiti and he said, hey, guys, you know, I'm in a bit of a pickle here. You know, I know you helped get me elected and all, but, you know, I need you to ante up a little for these projects or else the people are going to get mad. And those guys said, what? You think we're working for you? You're working for us. Get out of here. And they started to mount a campaign against him. And that's when he had these huge demonstrations. So, you know, he was fighting and fighting. And he said, in the course of it, he realized, Jovenel Moïse, and the U.S. had recruited him also for the campaign against Venezuela, to be the hood ornament on the front of the tank that was attacking Venezuela. And he did that for a few years. But by 2021, he was starting to say, hey, you know, this isn't working out too well for me because these guys are still attacking. The U.S. hasn't really got my back. And, Venezuela is still offering me cheap oil, and Russia is, offering things in this. And he, you know, started to flirt with Russians, flirt with the Venezuelans. The U.S. said, that's it. You're out of here, pal. And they dispatched the Colombians to go knock him off. I think we'll find out in the end. We don't have the 100% smoking gun proof, but for sure the U.S. was becoming very disenchanted, not only because he couldn't quell the rebellion, that was happening in the streets, but because he was starting to play footsie with the Venezuelans and the Russians. So, therefore, that's why we think they killed him.
Interesting, interesting. So, but the bottom line is the U.S. was in. I mean, it's pretty clear the U.S. was involved in rubbing it out.
Yeah,
you
pretty
say?
Clear. Yeah, they had at the very least, they had foreknowledge that it was going to go down. Now, it might have been some of the bourgeois. There was a guy called Reginald Boulos, who was in particular very much at odds with Jovenel Moïse, and another one called Dimitri Vorb. These were two big bourgeois families. But it seems it was a very large coalition from our sources here at Haiti Liberté, and they raised something like $21 million, which came in through Dominican banks. And the Dominicans weren't happy either because the Haitians, Jovenel Moïse, was talking about making a canal off the Massacre River in the north. And they didn't like the idea of that at all, because now Haiti was going to be able to start to grow its own food, and the Dominicans were not going to be able to sell all their food to the Haitians anymore. So they were starting to not like it either. So anyway, it ended up being an international conspiracy, maybe. The Dominicans had a hand in it, as well as the Americans, but certainly the bourgeoisie was very, very set on getting Jovenel out of there.
Wow. Well, so there we have it. And, you know, ultimately, as I said, isn't it correct that the current president or the guy that just stepped down was involved or at minimum was discussing, was talking with the people who assassinated the last president?
Yes, this is correct. I mean, what we know for sure, and we have evidence, and they just came out with a report. Some people might have seen a thing. Oh, it was Martin Moise's wife who was behind it. You know, this is a red herring. This is a diversion. This is a lie. She was like a partner, very close with Jovenel, clearly working with him. They were a team. But the one, you know, and you know, as a former cop, Garland, that, you know, grand juries, they're supposed to deal with evidence, not just hearsay and, you know, testimony. This, what a person testifies is not solid. It's the evidence, the hard evidence. And among that hard evidence, the hardest evidence are these phone records from the night of July 7th, when Ariel Henry, the prime minister who has just resigned, received two phone calls from Joseph Felix Badiou, who told the Colombian triggerman who machine gunned him to shoot. Badiou called and had 7 minutes of discussion with Ariel. And when Ariel was asked, "Oh, I don't remember the call. I got a lot of calls that night."
So let me just touch that for a second. So the night that Jovenel Moïse, the prime minister of Haiti, was assassinated,
at about 1 o'clock in the
morning. 1 o'clock in the morning. 3 hours later, the guy that was in charge of this assassination was on the phone with Ariel Henry, who's the president who just stepped down. And when asked about talking to the assassins on the night of the assassination of the previous president, he claimed, he couldn't remember.
Couldn't remember. He just, you know, it was too much going on, you know. Couldn't remember.
Wow. Yeah. That is. Well, hey, the bottom line is this. In a way, I put it like this. That's like they're laughing in our face. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To me, that's the ruling elite. It's like it's a way of saying, leave me alone. When the obvious is so when it's so blatant, right, that you know, somebody was involved in a crime and they just say, I don't remember. That to me is a way of saying, you know what? I don't you don't have a right to ask me. I don't have to tell you anything. So who cares? Just leave me alone.
Yeah, it's like, you know, some two-bit gangster, Jack Ruby, you know, he was so outraged by the assassination of John F. Kennedy that he goes and shoots Oswald and kills him. You know, and we're supposed to believe that, you know, that this guy just broke through seven lines of security and cops and shoots the guy in front of everybody. You know, come on.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, they really do think we're morons.
Well, luckily, we're not. You know, luckily, we're not. Yeah. And I think, you know, as Lenin discussed, the ruling elite creating the dynamics for revolution. The, you know, one of, to me, one of the things when you look at Haiti, they've done it there. They pushed the people of Haiti to a point where I think the people of Haiti have had enough. And they're just simply saying, you know what, we're not putting up with this crap anymore. You're not going to continue to do that. We're not going to just wander the streets and let the U.S. and France and Canada come in here. I mean, think about that for one second. France is all the way on the other side of the world. What is France doing involved with Haiti's business? What is Canada up in the north doing, having to do? You know what I mean? Why is it that these
they're mining gold? Yeah. Canada is mining gold in Haiti's north as we speak. There's some $20 billion worth of gold in the Haitian mountains of the north. But most of the gold veins were taken out by Columbus. And most of it's just dust. And how do you get a gold dust? Well, basically, you have to blow up the top of the mountains, and you have to sluice it with cyanide, and that's how you get it out. Now, that's great. You get some gold, but you also destroy the water table, and your rivers run red. So this is what they're trying to do in Haiti. So the Canadians have an interest. You know, they got a couple of Canadian mining companies interested there. Plus, Canadian is big in banking, and they have some banks. The U.S., we know, they, you know, have controlled Haiti since their 1915 occupation. And the French were the original colonizers of the country and always have had various minor interests. They're kind of really the junior partner. So really, it's a U.S. number one, Canada number two, France number three, as the three big neocolonial powers interested in Haiti. But as people can see in the film that Dan Cohen and I, Haiti Liberté, an uncaptured media, put out in November of 2022. It's called Another Vision. It's a three-part series. We really show how this this history and how it has basically squeezed the people into this hell that they've been living. And they've been saying, Jimmy Cherizier, who's the leader of the moment, the boogeyman of the moment too, has been saying consistently, we cannot keep living like this. We have already died. We are not afraid to die. We are going to liberate ourselves.
Well, you know, people are hearing Jimmy Cherizier. Oh, he's the evil guy. If I'm not mistaken, don't you
he's
guys?
A cannibal.
Don't. Oh, yeah. He's eating people. He's all the things because black folks eat people. What a terrible racist trope for them to use against black folks in Haiti. But here's my question. Again, people can go on YouTube and they can find, the name of it is Another Vision. It's a three-part documentary on Haiti. And if I'm not mistaken, doesn't Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier play a significant part of that documentary?
Oh, yes, yes. It really ends up being a portrait of Jimmy Cherizier and his movement, which is called the G9 originally. Which was an anti-crime vigilance brigade movement trying to stamp out crime in the neighborhoods of Haiti where it had emerged. Now he's the head of a thing called Vive Ensemble. Basically, the anti-crime coalition that he made was fighting a criminal coalition, which was surviving off of crime like kidnapping, extortion, rape. But the what he did basically 6 months ago, and we just dropped a video yesterday, which was sort of the emergence of this 6 months ago. He united all the gangs into one fighting force. And so if they manage to get in a proxy force into Haiti, or even if they come with the 82nd Airborne, they're going to face a well-armed, and I could say battle-hardened core of fighters in the city of Port-au-Prince and also in some of the other cities as well.
Wow. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. We know how. Look, all you got to do is look in Gaza. If you want to understand what Joe Biden and the neocons will do to innocent civilians, all you got to do is look at Gaza. They're doing that to the Palestinians, so you know what they'll do to black folks. Well, thank you very much. Certainly appreciate it. Kim Ives, once again, where can people find your stuff?
Haiti Liberté, that's liberty with an E, all one word, .com is our website. And on it, you can find many articles in French. There is an English section, which I edit, which is called This Week in Haiti. And there are quite a few videos. Most of them are in English because, you know, I'm the main English speaker here. Mm-hmm. So you'll see my face on a lot of those interviews, even though our staff of writers and editors are Haitian, but they mostly deal in French and Creole. So, yeah, for the English speakers in our audience, and I suppose most of our listeners are, you can look at that This Week in Haiti section and at the video section.
And don't forget, you can go on YouTube and find, it's a three-part series, a documentary. It's called Another Vision. It's called Another Vision. And for the most part, it covers Jimmy. If you've been reading the Washington Post, the New York Times, all this stuff about Jimmy Barbecue Cherizet, and you want to know all about him, watch Another Vision, three-part documentary that Kim and Dan put together, and you'll learn all about him, you'll hear him, you'll see him, etc. Thanks a lot, Kim Ives.
Thank you so much, Garland.
All right, talk to you soon. Me and my main man, Kalia, here have had a great hour, and I want to thank Kalia over there behind the glass for making this happen. Follow me online, Garland Nixon on YouTube, Garland.Nixon on Instagram, just plain old Garland Nixon on Facebook. You can email me. My email address is GarlandN. That's my first name and the first letter of my last name, GarlandN@gmail.com. Kalia, you know I'm in the mood for some African house music. Get me out of here.
Wishing a very happy birthday to WPFW. 47 years ago today, this station was born, and we've been speaking truth to power ever since. The news, the music,